listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
Do you remember the days of middle school or high school when every hair on your head had to be perfect? When wearing the kind of clothes your friends wore seemed more important than life itself? Do you remember how easily you could feel humiliated or embarrassed? How you tried to keep your friends in line so they didn't embarrass themselves or, more importantly, you? Perhaps you have young children now who will become teens, or a teenager who's going through this part of life now. I don't know about you, but when I went through this part of life, I got no help with my emotions. Today's times are wonderful because our kids can get help, and our guest today wants to help teens and the teenager in you to make sense of feelings, which is our topic for today. Welcome to Full Power Living, the only show on international media dedicated to the exploration and understanding of emotions and their role in human life. I'm Eileen Dillon, your host. We invite you to chat with us on the radio show page of blogtalkradio.com/FPL. Also, you can chat on emotionalpro.com on the radio show page. And we have a new toll-free call-in number. Make note of it. 888-498-0570. That's on both of the chats, so you can check it. 888-498-0570. Dr. Mary Lamia is a clinical psychologist and psychoanalyst who works with adults, teens, and children in Marin County, California, and she's also a professor at the prestigious Wright Institute in Berkeley, California. She's the author of a number of books, including Understanding Myself, A Kid's Guide to Intense Emotions and Strong Feelings. And she's the co-author of The White Knight Syndrome, Rescuing Yourself from Your Need to Rescue Others. She also blogs for PsychologyToday.com. For nearly a decade, she hosted a weekly call-in talk show, Kid Talk with Dr. Mary, on Radio Disney stations, and her opinion has been sought in hundreds of television, radio, and print media interviews and discussions. Dr. Lamia is a return guest here on Full Power Living. So welcome back, Dr. Mary Lamia.
Thank you for having me on, Eileen.
Well, as you can tell from the intro, I'm grateful that someone like you is interested in helping teens through the teen years, which is often very difficult because emotions run rampant, and I'm sure to all of us who have been teens, seemed like our emotions were poised to mess up our lives. And
very true. I wrote the book for children, for preteens, the Understanding Myself book, so many teens picked it up and read it and said, I sure wish I had this when I was a kid. And so many adults picked it up and said, I wish I had this information. I need it now. So I decided to write emotions for young adults and teens and even adults because all of us need that information. We didn't learn about emotions 30 years ago, 20 years ago, even 10 years ago. And so many kids now don't learn about their emotions, especially teens grapple with those.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wanted to ask you about that thing you just brought up, because it seems to me, as I was reading your book, which is entitled Emotions, Making Sense of Your Feelings, I was thinking to myself, it doesn't matter if you're a teenager, because often, because we didn't have help with our emotions when we were teens, we still have what you might call stuck emotions, or we still may be concerned about some of the same things we were humiliated about when we were teenagers. And I wanted to ask you if you'd talk a little bit about how what you've written here might be helpful to adults listening with their unfinished emotional business from their teen years.
First of all, it's so important to understand that emotions are normal to have. And people interpret their behavior as disordered when, in fact, their behavior is simply due to an emotion that is activated at the time. So emotions need to be understood and interpreted. And you know, we don't necessarily drag our emotions with us as much as we tend to respond to our emotions in the same way in which we did as children and teens. And if you understand what emotions are, what each emotion happens to be and what its purpose is, then you can alter the way in which you respond to that emotion and use it for your benefit. Every emotion has a purpose. Every single one has a purpose. An emotion is simply an amplification device in our brain. It's an attention-directing device. If you hear a loud noise coming from the right side of your body, it's actually an emotion that gives you that startle response that makes you turn your head to see what it is. So an emotion provides you with information, and it directs your attention, and it motivates your behavior. It makes you do something. It is designed to protect you by evolution, and it helps you reach your goals. So it's important just to understand them. Maybe I can give you an example later that will point that out, or I can give you one now if you'd like.
Well, as long as you brought it up, why don't you go ahead and give it? I have several.
Okay, well, my favorite one is sadness, because, of course, we all feel sad. Sadness is a natural emotion to feel when your goals are blocked. So let's say you're in love with somebody, and they don't love you back, and you are experiencing intense sadness. Sadness tells you something. It gives you information and directs your attention. Sadness is an emotion that tells you to accept reality. It motivates your behavior by telling you to realign your goals. It says, your goals are blocked. You have to change your goals and realign them, and I'm going to make you aware of that by making you feel sad. Sadness protects you by making you cautious. Sadness makes you slow down. It makes you observe yourself. Think about the last time you were sad. Sadness makes you introspective. All those love songs and poems that people write when they're sad, you know, that comes from the introspection of sadness. Now, sadness does not tell us to bury it, to drink, to take medications, to cut ourselves. It tells us to look at reality. And so when we're misguided regarding our emotions, we might do something to try to get rid of it, rather than say, what is my emotion trying to tell me? And if people could just say, when they feel something, what is this emotion trying to tell me? They'll be so far ahead of the game.
Mm-hmm. It strikes me that one of the reasons people do things like take drugs or cut themselves, that long list that you just put out there, is because they, at least when I have clients come to me, they say, I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do with this emotion. I feel overwhelmed by this emotion. And it seems to me a big thrust of the book that you have now written, Emotions, is saying, look, there are things you can do. First of all, recognize that this emotion is trying to benefit you in some way. Secondly, understand what each emotion is telling you. And third, do what it says. Do I get that right?
Exactly. And if you understand the emotion and what certain emotions tell you, what they're designed to tell you, then you won't be so overwhelmed with them. And actually, a lot of people do these kinds of things when they're overwhelmed by an emotion, like drinking or taking medication or cutting themselves, hurting themselves in some way, because actually they're motivated to activate another emotion to get rid of the one they feel.
Uh-huh.
So if you cut yourself, you activate a different emotion. So basically, if people just knew that when an emotion is activated, such as sadness, and they could ask themselves a few questions like, why did my brain trigger that specific emotion? Because your brain does this automatically and unconsciously, and that's the beauty of emotions. It's so exciting to learn about them and to know that your brain works for you and unconsciously triggers emotion. It appraises the environment, and it has a like an appraisal system, we call it, and it triggers an emotion if it thinks you need to be informed about something. And so you could say to yourself, well, why did my brain trigger this emotion, and what is the action of the emotion directing me to do? Because every emotion has attached to it an action potential, we call it, a potential for action. So what is it telling me to do? And is it correct for the situation, or is it exaggerated? Because there is emotional misfires. I mean, your brain can't always get it right. So you have to kind of consider, is it right for the situation? And did it consider a past situation when it decided to trigger the emotion in the present? You know, because we have emotional memories that are stored in our brain, and they're completely implicit, unconscious. And your brain is so fast that it'll evaluate all of your memories and instantaneously fire that emotion out there, but it's based on previous experience, and that experience may distort what your brain decides to do. It's not your brain's fault. It's now, kind of the fault of your experiences.
And one of the points that you make that I think is really important in emotions, making sense of your feelings, is that the brain working 24/7 brings you the information, but you still have a choice about what action you choose to take. I think that's a really vital point.
Absolutely. For example, anger is a good one in terms of an example for that, because a lot of people think that if their brain triggers anger, then they should express that anger. Well, We do have a choice, and when your brain triggers the emotion of anger and the action potential associated with it, it makes you feel hot, it gives you a tremendous amount of energy and a greater willingness to take risks. But the real purpose of anger is not to slug somebody. The purpose of anger is to prepare you to take action in case you need to protect yourself for some reason. So if the action in response to goals that are blocked you think is to slug somebody, well, you do have a choice, actually. There's ways to get around your goals that are blocked without hurting somebody else.
Uh-huh.
Or now, to remedy situations that are wrong without hurting somebody else.
You know, you say that anger is, and I quote here, is meant to be an adaptive internal signal that cues self-protective action, and that it alerts you to circumstances that seem unjust or should not be as they are. And in my work with anger, that's one of the things that I see as a primary, is that anger gets triggered when we think things should not be as they are, or they should be different than they are. So I was glad
right.
to see that.
Yes, yeah. Anger was designed to help us deal with the violation of social norms or to remedy situations that are wrong. It alerts us to take action, and that's self-protective. When you think about the evolution of human beings, you know, we weren't living in the society as we do now, but having that kind of an emotion, the potential for that kind of action to be able to have anger was really, really self-protective. And it's still self-protective, but it doesn't mean, again, that you have to take the action that you think you have to take. And that's where all of your emotional memories play a part, because you have this little reservoir of emotional memories where you learned as a child that if your goals are blocked or somebody violates you, you learn to respond in a violent way, you're just going to continue to do that. And people have to be directed to listen to their emotion. What is your emotion really telling you? It's telling you your goals are blocked and that you need to protect yourself and maybe take a risk in doing so. but it doesn't tell you to take that particular action to slug somebody.
Right, right. Well,
and also, you know, parents teach their children sometimes to vent their anger or to get revenge, or children see their parents wanting revenge. And that does not help.
Well, you know, my learning is that taking revenge actually tends to destroy self-esteem. And that has always been really instructive to me.
That's so interesting. How do you see those two together? I'm so interested in that.
Well, one of the things that you need to learn to do when you're for self-esteem is you need to learn to listen to your inner voices and pick out the one that's going to give you the greatest benefit. And when you deliberately hurt somebody, the way we are made up, now I'm not backing this up with research, but I have clinical
experience.
Research, I would say, for 40 years. When we deliberately hurt somebody, because we're connected, we are literally hurting ourselves at the same time, and that's how it ends up destroying it. It's very subtle, but it does just destroy your self-esteem. It makes you not feel good about who you are.
Because if you hurt another human being, if you withhold your empathy that much, and anger does suppress empathy, you do have to cognitively justify it in some way, and that could hurt your self-esteem as well.
Well, I remember years ago, Mary, I had been separated from my husband since our daughter was 10 months old. And when she was about 10 years old, she had a younger brother, and she came home from visiting her father one day and told me that she had recruited her younger brother, and the two of them were literally torturing her stepmother. And she told me because she didn't feel good about it. And I was grateful to her that she did tell me, because we were able to get things straightened out so that she didn't continue that. But
well, Eileen, you just brought up something really, really important about guilt, you know, and why I titled the chapter in that book, The Goodness of Guilt. Uh-huh. Guilt is a good thing. It alerts you to not behave in a way that might breach a social bond or a relationship in general. And that's exactly what she was telling you.
Yes.
You know, guilt motivates you to correct or repair a situation where a social bond is breached. We're motivated. Guilt motivates you to relieve how the guilt makes you feel in the first place and to restore the relationship. So, obviously, you must have been teaching your daughter something about her feelings for her to be able to say that.
Well,
and that's just so exact.
Yeah, it was so
bad.
It was so powerful, and that is exactly what we moved to do, Mary, what you're talking about. Actually, her father and stepmother and my daughter went to therapy together to find out what it was that was causing her to pick at the stepmother. And, you know, I now am a stepmother myself, and I understand that it's difficult when you come in to a family to assert your full power. Like I remember one time telling she's now my adopted daughter, my husband's youngest. Her mother died when she was 12, and I did a step-parent adoption. And she was about 8 or 9 years old, and I said to her, don't you think it would be a good idea to take a bath? I always enjoy how I feel after a bath. And she and I had been talking about manipulation. She went up and took her bath, but she came back down and she said, Eileen, you manipulated me. And I said, you know, you're right, I did. And then I thought about it, and I said, I'll tell you why I did. I said, if you were Liz or John, my daughter or son that I raised and birthed, I would just tell you, get your behind upstairs and take a shower, right? But I don't have a position with you, so it's difficult for me to do that. And she said first, you'd say that to them? And I said, Yes, I would. And she came back a few minutes later and she said, you know, it's fine with me if you just tell me, Robin, please go take a shower.
Oh. But you see, if you speak with your children in a way that helps them understand the dynamics between you, then if they experience something like shame, for example, and shame disconnects people from relationships, or often when there's a disconnection in a relationship, one feels shamed. And if a child can talk about what they feel and take a look at it and have it motivate them to work through a relationship, I mean, it's just so important. But we disregard those emotions.
Well, we're fortunately closing in on ending that behavior. We're up to our first break right now, Mary. We're talking today with clinical psychologist and psychoanalyst Dr. Mary Lamia regarding the release of her latest book, Emotions, Making Sense of Your Feelings, which is particularly aimed toward teens and the people who love them. She is telling us how our friends are how our emotions are friends to us, and we'll look more at pride and shame when we return here on Full Power Living.
You're listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
As a parent, have you found all the parenting information you've been hearing lately a bit confusing? Are you having trouble sorting out the best response to your defiant child, or feeling hopeless about regaining respect from your teen, or determining whether your actions as a parent are the right ones? Instead of the usual pressures of parenting that you've been experiencing, you can partner with your child, raising incredible kids who are destined to become amazing adults. I'm Eileen Dillon, the Emotional Pro, giving you the opportunity to become the incredible parent for incredible kids. We have the method and the tools. You bring your optimism for learning and the kids. Raise Incredible Kids offers a comprehensive system for raising kids who are responsible, make their own great decisions, and become immune to peer pressure. To get you ready for this new era in parenting, get my free 10-page report, Incredible Communication That Helps You Create Incredible Kids, by visiting RaiseIncredibleKids.com now. That's RaiseIncredibleKids.com. Welcome back to Full Power Living. I have a few announcements. You remember that upcoming guests are listed at the top of our radio show page on EmotionalPro.com. Next week, I'm talking with Daniel Rechnitzer, who is the author of the, I hope I learned how to say that smoothly, that's a hard name, Rechnitzer. He's author of The All-Knowing Diary, about how to harness all-knowing in order to make the right decisions every time. This should be a very interesting exploration. Join me for all the shows on Full Power Living, and I also want to thank you for helping us with our mission of transforming our world through the mastery and power of human emotions. Keep your emails coming. I've recently been hearing from several people who tell me they've been listening to Full Power Living for years and have benefited from what we offer. I'm at Eileen, I-L-E-N-E, at EmotionalPro.com, and I love hearing from you. If you do miss any of our live broadcasts or you want to share with your friends and family, download the archived podcast from these sites or subscribe to Full Power Living on iTunes. Today, we're talking with professor, clinical psychologist, and psychoanalyst Dr. Mary Lamia, who, in addition to writing, works with adults, teens, and kids in an office near my own office in Kentfield, California. And Dr. Lamia, you also did a radio program for Disney, Radio Disney stations for a while. What was the biggest thing you learned from being, I think you said it was 9 years, Kid Talk with Dr. Mary on Radio Disney? What was the biggest thing you learned about kids from that show?
The biggest thing I learned about kids was that they truly need someone who will patiently listen to them and what they have to say and what they feel. And so the first book I wrote on emotions for preteens has a number of quotes in that book, and they are actually from the kids who called into that program. And they were absolutely desperate to have somebody patiently listen to what they had to say. And especially in a trusted adult. And I got thousands and thousands of emails from the kids who listened. Those who couldn't call in or get through would send an email, and they just wanted to be heard. Kids really do need someone who could listen, and they desperately want to be heard. It feels good when you can tell someone you trust, even if it's some stranger on a radio program. It was astonishing to me how revealing these kids would be on a public radio show. But they were so desperate to be heard and to share that they would do it.
You know, that can only carry forward into our adult lives. Maybe we have a little bit more ability to insist that people listen to us when we're adults, but my own experience would tell me that there must be a huge number of people in the world who just want to be listened to, and that those of you who are listening to this show can do the world a favor by listening to even one person fully this week.
Yes, and or even listening to your spouse. How often it is that people are married for many years or associated with the same person or partner for many years, and we think it's okay not to listen anymore or pay attention.
Mm-hmm.
Human beings need attention, and just paying attention to being attentive with your partner is very, very important. Sure. Just ask about their day or something specific about what they're doing, and to remember that you can't necessarily ignore the person you're living with.
Nor do
and
they.
That happens all the time. How many husbands or wives or partners have you heard in your own practice, Eileen, who say to you, my wife doesn't listen to me, my partner doesn't listen to me, or my wife can talk for hours on the phone with her good friend, but she doesn't talk to me for more than 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Happens all the time.
Really, it does.
And we have to remember that with our children, we think just because we're in the house with them that it's enough, when in fact, we need to pay attention.
Well, you know, that's interesting because about 14 years ago, I married my husband, and he did grow up in a house where he was well taken care of, but in his household, that's the way people related. We're in the same house, we're a family, we're close, but they didn't talk much. And so I can comment on what it's like to become a partner with someone who has the idea that if you're in the same house, you're connected in a deep way. And it's something that he and I have spent a lot of time working through. And I was appreciating when you were talking that every evening about 5 o'clock, we close down what we're doing and meet in the living room and talk for about an hour before we have dinner.
Oh, that's wonderful. What a wonderful thing to do. You know, interest is a very, very important emotion. And whether it's interest in an activity or in something you're reading or in another person, in relationships, interest is essential. And it's related to and motivates excitement and exploration and attention and perception and challenge. And having a mutual interest with somebody or just being interested in who they are or what they're doing is so important because interest is an emotion, and emotions connect people.
Right. Oh, that's so wonderful. I also have learned that there are 7 skills of love, and one of those is a desire to get to know the other person. So when somebody falls in love, for example, you just want to know everything about the other person. And that is part of the love package. And so, you know, exercising interest in the way that you're talking about, I just want to emphasize, to me, that means you're also conveying love to them.
Oh, absolutely. And and again, if you talk to people, I'm sure you have in your practice as well as I have, if you talk to people who end up leaving their marriages or their partnerships, often they will tell you that some other person pulled them out of their relationship because this other person was really interested in them.
And listened
to them. And that's all it is. It's the emotion of interest that connects us. And excitement,
mm-hmm.
You know, excitement, you know, and you don't even necessarily have to have bliss, but you do need to have interest and enjoyment as emotions that connect you. Otherwise, what you get into is people end up in relationships feeling the emotion of shame as though they are not good enough or they attack themselves. Shame makes you do one of four things. It makes you attack yourself, like you're not good enough in order for somebody to be interested in you. It can make you attack the other person, like the other person isn't good enough and you don't like them anymore. Or it can make you withdraw, which many people do, or it makes you avoid.
Mm-hmm.
So those four things that shame makes you do when you're disconnected from your partner are just poison to a relationship.
And as I was reading Emotions, your book, I was thinking that certainly it was true of me. I never paid much attention to shame until I was asked to write a book about it, and I realized
really?
That I'm full of it, you know?
You know, we're all full of shame. It is probably the most dominant emotion in humans, and yet we've not paid any attention to it.
Right. Right. And now here's the other thing that I found very interesting, and that is you talk about bullying in your book, and we tend to think that people who bully, or it's been promulgated that people who bully have low self-esteem, but you say no, you think they're full of shame. Can you tell us about that?
Right. Yeah, we do commonly believe that those who bully do so because they have low self-esteem. And what's unfortunate about that is if you tell a child, well, you know, that person who bullied you really has low self-esteem, we think we're helping the child by helping them have empathy for the bully and understand why the bully bullied. But the basic premise is wrong to begin with. You know, all the research has shown that people who behave like bullies have high self-esteem, that in fact they're very shame-prone. They fear their failures or shortcomings will be exposed, and their mean behavior towards others keeps their self-esteem high. It takes the attention away from their shame. Shame makes you want to hide and not let anybody else know that that part of you exists. And bullies are able to hide from their own shame so effectively because they bring shame out in others. And
mm-hmm.
they're masterful at making others feel ashamed.
Well, because they're
with
so
confident.
They're so
because
in rapport with shame, yeah. Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah. And the confidence of people who bully doesn't come from high self-esteem. It actually comes from hubristic pride. An overly self-confident attitude that's, sort of related to being proud of who you are in an egotistical or arrogant way.
Right.
You know, hubris hides one's proneness to experience shame also. Hubris is poison as well. Pride is a wonderful, wonderful emotion. But when it gets to the point of hubris, it's poison for people.
It goes from...
It's like narcissism.
It goes from wonderful to poison. Well, and another point that you made that I found interesting is that fear of failure is also related to shame, that most of us think we're afraid to fail, but that's not really your understanding. Tell us what fear of failure is really all about.
Yeah, fear of failure is related to the emotions of anxiety and shame. Now I have to backtrack a little bit here because there's a lot of there's a lot of different approaches to the emotions of anxiety and fear. The people who focus on fear claim that anxiety is a subset of fear. Some people claim that anxiety is different than fear. But for the moment, let's just say it's all one. So the fear of failure is actually a positive attribute in people, because what people do is they try to avoid any humiliation that would accompany failure to achieve a goal. So you're driven to succeed because you're avoiding the shame of failure. And so you're so afraid of looking like a failure that it makes you succeed. So when people say, I have a fear of failure, actually, most of those people are very successful people. You know, some people say they have a fear of failure so they don't try, but that's very few. Actually, I did a study of highly successful people, and every single one of them claimed to have a tremendous fear of failure. Like on a Likert scale of 1 to 5, they marked a 5.
I actually heard my daughter, who got a master's degree at the University of California, Davis, tell her younger brother, my son, who's 7 years younger, that she was, every time she did something in school, by the way, she was top graduate in as an undergraduate and with her master's degree in her department, which was communication. She was the top graduate. She told my son that she was afraid of failing everything she did, and that's what she used to make sure she got things done right.
So. And there's your emotion of shame, you know, because if we fail, we don't feel guilt. It's shame.
Uh-huh.
And shame is highly, it's like the fear of shame. The fear of shame is highly, highly motivating.
Uh-huh.
And when you think about how shame is experienced in your body and cognitively, how bad it makes you feel, because shame doesn't separate out yourself from the deed, from the action. If you experience shame, your whole self is bad. When you experience guilt, you're focused on what you did. But shame, you're all bad. And so people do everything they can to avoid shame. Bullies give it away, or we fear failure so we succeed. Or if we feel shame, we hide it. And you often see in people who go to psychotherapy, it takes them a while, but once they trust, they will reveal something about which they feel tremendous shame that has plagued them.
Mm-hmm.
And often you see it behind addictions, alcoholism and drug abuse. There's often a shame that may not even be the person's fault. It may be something that was done to them. A rape, a molestation as a child, whatever it is, for which they feel the shame. So sad.
That was true of me. I remember as a young, in my young 20s, I had some of that history you've just listed. I was afraid to look people in the eye because I thought there was something wrong with me and that other people would be able to see it, but I didn't really quite know what it was.
Oh. And that downcast gaze from shame, you know, broadcast to the world that we feel bad about ourselves.
Right. Well,
it's also important to teach kids to have the stance of pride so they can broadcast to the world that they feel good about themselves. But, yes, shame is so hurtful.
Yes, it really is. We're up to our second break. And when we come back, Mary, I'd like to have you talk a little bit about comparison, because I think that is at the basis of a lot of difficulty that kids, maybe all of us, have with emotions, is that we compare ourselves to others. We're talking today with clinical psychologist and psychoanalyst Dr. Mary Lamia regarding emotions, making sense of your feelings. And we'll be talking a little bit about happiness as well as comparisons when we come back. You're listening to Full Power Living. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
That emotionally, children form the foundation for their life during their first 7 years. Most adults just repeat that early emotional learning, good or bad, over and over for the rest of their lives. If you want to give your child an opportunity to live an emotionally masterful life, then join me, Eileen Dillon, also known as the Emotional Pro, for a free one-hour teleseminar on what it takes for your child to become an emotional master. You'll discover important things like what emotions are designed to do for us, four things it's vital for parents to tell their children about emotions, and the single most important thing to do when someone is feeling emotion. Register now at RaiseIncredibleKids.com. The time has come for us to allow emotions their rightful place in our lives, as the tools and helpers they're created to be. Find out what you need to know in order to give this vital information to your children so they can live emotionally masterful lives. Go now to RaiseIncredibleKids.com for your free emotional mastery teleseminar. Welcome back to Full Power Living, and to follow up on that commercial, let me also suggest that you look into Dr. Mary Lamia's books, including the new one, Emotions! Making Sense of Your Feelings. Dr. Lamia, where can people get your books?
Any of the online booksellers or bookstores, or they can go to my website, and there are links there, and that website is www.marylamia.com. That's L-A-M-I-A.
Perfect. Thank you. So in this book, Emotions, you have a lot of psychological research to support what you say. You're so glib with it. You've been essentially quoting it the whole time we've been having this show, but if a person hadn't read your book, you wouldn't realize that everything you're saying is backed up by some research that you have that you present in the book. And the other clever thing that you do, which I think is really good for teenagers, is every chapter, if it's on anxiety or anger or whatever, is only 5 or 6 pages long. So if I'm having a trouble with anger, say, I go to those 5 or 6 pages and read it, and I think that's really great. But I
also made a "What's it to you?" section in every chapter, so that the person reading it could take a look at that, and it brings it to life more, and it puts it in context. But doing the research was actually fun. I learned a lot.
I know you did, because I've done that. But you also in that section, you offer suggestions for what people can do, most especially the way I look at things, what they can pay attention to in order to work with a particular emotion. And I like that.
Yes.
One of the points you make, though, is that often people are comparing, especially in the teen years, you're comparing yourself with others. And I wanted you to talk about comparisons.
Sure, you compare yourself with others, but you also compare yourself with whatever you have created in your mind as an ideal that's based on what you know or what you've imagined. And that can also be very difficult for people and lead them to feel shame and as though they're not good enough. Generally, around that topic, social comparisons, lurk the emotions of envy and jealousy. Actually, jealousy is not necessarily an emotion. Jealousy involves a social triangle, and it's more an emotional scene or a plot that can trigger emotions. But envy often comes up around comparisons, and envy has a purpose in terms of that. So you look at somebody walking down the street or somebody you know, and you say, and all of a sudden envy is triggered in you, and you just feel sort of uncomfortable and yucky and wish they would just disappear off the face of the earth and obsess about them. You know, what does envy tell you? Rather than get so caught up in the emotion of envy and feel the hostility that can come with it, you know, envy tells you that you want something, whatever it is, that someone else has, and that whatever it is that you envy seems to have some limited availability, and it gives that person an advantage or power. So you want that quality or possession, you want to have that advantage or power, and the hostility you feel toward the other person and the suffering you feel within yourself sort of helps you come up with a solution. Either you defer to the person you envy and you say, well, you know, they are smarter than I am and we all have different interests and talents and skills, and so I just have to give them that. Why feel hostile about it? Or somehow some people try to eliminate the envied person. And I guess in prehistoric times we did that, and I guess still today we do that in other ways. People can be really hostile and cruel to others who they envy. I think envy is an important emotion, and people get really caught up in the way it makes them feel because it makes you not feel so pleasant about yourself, and you obsess about the person you envy for good reason, by the way.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things, and you certainly, you just now alluded to it as well. When I talk about the signal that this emotion gives, I say that it signals us to become more creative. Because when we're busy looking at what somebody else has that we can't have, we're giving all of our energy and attention away to the other individual and nothing to ourselves.
Absolutely.
Right.
And the other person just happens to embody whatever it is you want. It's not their fault, but how wonderful that your brain has told you what you want. And so how are you going to get that for yourself?
Exactly.
And this is why people obsess about those they envy. You know, the research has shown that you're more likely to think about a person you envy and pay attention to details about them and correctly remember that information. And it even interferes with your cognitive skills a little bit because it preoccupies you. So if you find yourself envying another person, the thing to do is to use your willpower to focus on the attributes and qualities you have and how you can gain whatever admired quality it is that you want.
Mm-hmm. I work with
take it away from somebody.
That's really great advice. I worked with a woman one time who was envious of her husband, who was taking a trip to New York City from California, and she wanted to go. And she came to a therapy group I was running, and she was very upset and grumbling about him. And so I used this approach and asked her to give herself permission that she could have the trip to New York, too, if she wanted to. Of course, she had a whole list of reasons why she couldn't. But as soon as she realized that she could have it, she realized she didn't want to go to New York at all because New York, it was winter, and she didn't want to go there. She wanted to go to Hawaii, and she created a trip to Hawaii and went. So that was that was really great. We have a caller, Rhea. So she has a question for you, Dr. Mary. Rhea, are you on the line?
Hi, yes, I'm here. This is Leah.
Hi, Rhea.
Leah, I'm sorry.
Yes, Leah. Hi. I guess maybe it's a little simplistic, but how do I know if what I'm feeling is normal? Because sometimes when I get to a place and I have so much regret about decisions and things that I did when I was much younger, and I'm trying to work myself out of it, but I'm so down, how do I know if what I'm feeling at that moment is normal or if I really should maybe be talking to someone about it?
That's difficult to assess with limited information, Leah, but what you're describing is such a beautiful shame response. And all of those things that we've done in the past about which we feel shame come up for us over and over and over again. Is that normal? Absolutely normal. Should you get help with it? Well, if you can't take a look at it and come to terms with it, yes, it could help you to get help with it. But is the response itself normal? Absolutely. So let's just say your emotional memories get triggered, and this is what happens. See, you could be just going about your daily experiences and your daily tasks, and something that reminds your brain of something in the past that made you feel ashamed will trigger that memory. And then you start thinking about it. Oh, I remember when this happened to me, and this is what I did. And then it just sort of plagues you. Now, we can't get rid of our emotional memories, but we can change the way in which we deal with them. So there's one researcher who calls shame the best teacher ever. If you could look at a shame response you have and say to yourself, what did I learn from that experience that I could use in my present life? What did that experience teach me by giving me so much ugly shame? Then you'll come to terms with it and be able to better let it go. But shame is a wonderful teacher, and shame experiences come up for us more than any other. We remember them, and they hurt like heck. But
can
they're the best teacher.
Can I put something in here, because I think it's really important, Mary. I really like what you're saying there. And that is that a lot of times, at least I used to do this when I was full of shame, Leah, a lot of times we think we've done something wrong when, if you stand back and look at it, what we did was the best we knew how to do at the time we were there. It's what it took for us to break out, even if we wouldn't choose it now. And for that reason, we need to forgive ourselves.
Wow. And you're right. You're so
good. Yes, and just look at it. You know what? Use it as a golden opportunity when you feel so lousy and you're remembering regrets, when you have regrets. It is shame knocking at your door saying, look at me, learn something from me, and move forward and connect with people, and don't hide just because you feel me. Look at me.
Nice.
You know, the downcast eyes that Eileen, expressed when at a moment when she felt shame, you know, shame makes us not want to look at ourselves, and in fact, that's what we have to do. Because it consumes us.
And from my own, and Mary, from my own experience, I have now learned. I just turned 70 this week. I have learned that. Thank you. That we're supposed to be able to move past those early experiences. We're supposed to heal. Is that your experience too?
We move past them and heal if we learn. If we can use them as guides and teachers,
yes.
I think then we could move on. And sometimes, you know, what it takes is somebody appreciating us and loving us in order for us to look at ourselves. Otherwise, it's hard to do alone at times. That's where a good partner helps, or a therapist, or whoever. But you can do it alone. It just is a little bit easier when you feel that somebody loves you and will look at those things with you and not blame you, but accept you, and then you can accept yourself. But, yeah, shame's a good teacher. And I have a new relationship with shame since I've learned so much about it, and I'm just enamored with what I have learned. It's such an important emotion, and it makes people feel so terrible and disappointed and remorseful, regret, all of those things, when in fact it's just trying to tell us something.
Well, Leah, thank you so much for your question. You really got a feast from Dr. Mary, and I hope that it's helpful to you in your life.
Yes.
Thank you for your call.
Thanks for calling, Leah.
Having me.
Uh-huh. Bye. Bye-bye. So, Dr. Mary, in this culture, so many people seem to be seeking happiness, and you dove into the psychological research to find out what happens when we go looking for happiness, and I want you to tell us what you found out.
Oh, yes. Actually, you know, we think of happiness as an emotion, but happiness is not an emotion. Happiness is made up of many emotions like gladness, elation, relief, joy, bliss, amusement, I guess. All those as positive emotions, or happiness, being happy is a positive emotion. But you know, happiness and the pursuit of happiness is really complex, and I wrote a Psychology Today blog about this because so many people value happiness and feeling positive, but valuing happiness can make you miserable. You know, if you value happiness, you're valuing a goal that's not even tangible, and the goals about being happy differ among people so much in our culture. But researchers found that people who highly value happiness tend to set standards for it that are hard to achieve. And when you can't obtain the standard you've set for yourself, you're bound to be disappointed. So in the end, people may feel worse off the more they want it, and that valuing or overvaluing happiness can lead you to be less happy. Even if happiness is in, you know, your reach, you might be less happy just because of the way you're approaching it.
That's so
wonderful.
So happiness
is very complex.
Yeah, I just found it very, very interesting because so many people are seeking happiness. It just strikes me, you know, not everything. I've noticed it especially when I go on vacation. You know, vacations are supposed to be really happy experiences. And sometimes when I'm on vacation, I'm asking myself, am I really happy right now? And I may feel content, or I may feel vaguely uneasy, or I may feel even upset. And the reality is that I'm having a real life while I'm on vacation, and it's not all happiness. And if I think that I'm supposed to be happy, then I'm going to mess myself up, just like you said.
What an amazing example. I never thought about vacations, but vacations are a prime example of this.
Well, you can use it
in my blog. Thank you.
You're quite welcome.
Think about how when you plan a vacation, the expectation is of bliss, of happiness. Everything is going to be perfect when you go to Hawaii or wherever you're going, or when you see the relatives, or when you go home for the holidays. And because we overvalue it and we create this illusion, I guess, in our mind, when we have it, we're so disappointed and we have so many regrets, when in fact, if we didn't overvalue it in the first place, we might appreciate more what we did get. Yeah.
Wonderful.
A very good example of that.
And so your blog is on psychologytoday.com?
Right.
If they
just search Mary Lamia, they'll get to the blog. And interestingly enough, the blog I wrote on happiness can make you miserable. I think it's something like that. The pursuit of happiness can make you miserable. Probably got, of all the blogs I've written, it got thousands of hits and reads because of that. That one and one on jealousy.
Interesting. Interesting.
Shows you what affects people.
What we wrestle with all the time.
What we wrestle with.
Right. So, unfortunately, we need to stop. Emotions, Making Sense of Your Feelings. That's Dr. Lamia's book. And clearly, even though she has aimed it to teenagers, as you demonstrated for us, Leah, with your questions, it's helpful to all of us, no matter what your age. But I do also recognize that it's really well done to help our teenagers through potentially tough life terrain. So I thank you for writing it, Dr. Lamia, and also for sharing it with us today. And
thank you for having me on.
Yeah. Well, it's just a pleasure to have you, and I'm looking forward to talking with you when you put out your next book. I'll bet you're already working on it.
I actually am, one on meanness.
One on what?
Meanness.
Meanness.
Meanness hurts.
Yes, it does. Wow. See, I apologize, but I really got that you're a person who just loves doing this, and you just move from one project to the next because of your interest. Is that so?
Because interest is just a wonderful emotion, and if you want to feel alive, find an interest.
That's wonderful. All right. Well, thank you for being with us today, and we look forward
thank
to the
you.
Next time. Join us live every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific time, which is noon Eastern, for more powerful experiences on Full Power Living. Don't forget that next week I'm talking with Daniel Rechnitzer about what he gleaned from his own search to find his purpose, which now will inform your search for purpose. Please join us. Paul and Robin Johnston of Fresh Talk Media are our producers. Thank you both for your technical wizardry. For now, I'm Eileen Dillon, your host, reminding you, pay attention not to what you want to overcome, but to what you want to become.
You're listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.